Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to you all. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mudiwa Gabaza, and for today, we're talking about something that's very near and dear to my heart, and that is business financing. We typically look at it from a startup point of view. We have spoken to a number of different startups on this specific platform around some of their various capital raises, over the last couple of years. I think most recently it was Naked Insurance, and they had just raised 700 million rand, which was a pretty big funding round, for this specific country. But for today, we are going to be talking to a group that has raised an even bigger amount of money, $69 million, and they operate in a number of different territories. $10 million has been committed to South Africa, and depending on when you're listening to this, that's at let's call it 180 to 190 million rand, because of the exchange rate, which tends to fluctuate. And that's the team from Flow 48, and we're going to try and understand what they are doing in the space. And talk about the fact that they're redefining SME financing, and by building a seamless capital infrastructure that they say transforms future revenues into immediate working capital. To make sense of it all and to explain what some of those terms I've just said actually mean, we are joined by Altesh Baiju, and we're just going to understand what's happening. Altesh, greetings to you today.
Madhival, greetings to you, and thank you for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.
I've just explained Flow 48 in using a what sounds like a complex sentence from the outside. What does taking future revenue and turning it into immediate working capital actually mean? Maybe give us some understanding of the Flow 48 model and and how the mechanism actually works.
Yeah, sure. So at a very high level, we are a fintech business, which means that we leverage technology quite significantly end-to-end in what we do. But we've got two products, and to try and make sense of what you've said, but SMEs tend to have less mature income statements and balance sheets, which means that if you had to try to assess whether they qualify for a loan utilizing traditional methods, i.e. look at the historical financial statements, try to understand their fundamentals, it's probably not the best gauge for SMEs to be able to give them credit. So what we tend to do is we look at an indication from a revenue perspective, and we've got two products. One is a revenue-based finance product. The other is an invoice-based finance product. I'll start with the invoice-based finance product. Essentially, what that means is most SMEs would have clients in the form of corporates or multinationals. They provide a service to the corporate, and then they submit an invoice, and most corporates tend to give them payment terms that are in excess of 60 days, sometimes 90 to 120 days. And that creates a cash flow constraint for the SMEs. What the SME then can do is they can come to us. We look at the face value of the invoices, and we monetize up to 80% of the invoices, which means that they unlock that cash way sooner than whatever the payment terms associated with that. That's a fairly easy product to understand, and it enables an SME to access cash fairly quickly relative to their accounts receivable. The revenue-based finance product is slightly different. What we look at there is we try and utilize information and data, alternative sources of data, to give us a very accurate picture of what the historical as well as forward revenue of the business is going to be. And then we take a credit decision based on that picture itself, and we allocate capital to the business. I'll give you an example. If you utilize POS data, it gives you a very good indication of a merchant's revenue that's being generated through a point of sale provider. And let's just say the business is doing $1 million through a point of sale provider. We then have a level of comfort to give that business 200,000 rand in loans. So it's 20% of the revenue that's moving through that POS. And then to de-risk ourselves relative to the traditional mechanisms, what we do is before the revenue that's due to the merchant is paid to the merchant, we take the amount that's due to us and then pay the rest over to the merchant itself. Does that make sense?
No, it certainly does, because when it comes to discounted future cash flows, that's one of the ways in which people have been able to determine valuations of businesses, from a present day point of view. This is the first time personally I've heard, such a model being used around granting a line of credit. And I'm very keen to maybe understand why you decided to go that route. And I ask that because on this platform, we've actually spoken to a number of different fintech operators and providers. And without going, I don't want to label you too much, but you sort of sound like you're operating in what people call, alternative lending, where you're using a different set of criteria than your traditional operators to, credit score, some of these businesses, etc. In this particular case, you're talking about, invoicing and that type of thing, as one of the metrics that you're using. What's the POS data telling you about trading activity of a particular merchant or small business and that type of thing? So it's very interesting to always gauge, the criteria that, different alternative lenders actually use. So I'm keen in your rationale around why you decided that that was the way forward. In my head, it seems like, an easy one, and it's an easy way to also de-risk yourselves. But I'm sure you probably thought through, a number of different iterations before you arrived at this point.
Yeah, so it's a great thought process, and to understand exactly why, fintech and lending specifically has been around in some way, shape, or form for in greater 15 years globally. In South Africa, probably around 50, probably close to that amount as well. And initially, when fintech lenders started, they were kind of replicating very much what banks did. So they looked at very much fundamental analysis, looking at your annual financial statements, potentially management accounts. But as time has progressed and technology has improved, especially with the ability of like APIs and so on, you can actually integrate into various different data providers and extract data that allows you to get a better risk profile and get a risk profile that's not exclusively reliant on management accounts or financial statements. So, for example, you can extract bank statement data. You can plug into the credit bureaus to get information on directors and so on. And then you can plug into ERP data, POS data. This ability to be able to do that and aggregate data and then overlay algorithms on top of that to give you a better understanding of what the credit risk associated with the business is, not just SMEs, obviously, but it's very applicable to SMEs because that's where it's a very alternative approach to looking at it, just made sense for us as a technology business. So we asked ourselves, what do we need to build from a tech stack perspective in order to basically improve two things, operational efficiency and capital efficiency? And when we started to investigate all of these trends globally, you started to realize that there's just so many of these data sources that are coming online as a result of digitization of businesses, that there's an inherent ability to be able to plug into these things to better understand the risk associated with SMEs, if that makes sense.
It certainly makes sense, and I like the rationale, and how you guys have taken that approach, when it comes to actually lending out to people. I want to dive a little bit deeper into some of the finer detail, sure, around that lending, etc. But before that, because you had already started talking about maybe some of the historical context, how you guys, came up with this model. You guys are two and a half years old. And one of your operating countries, is South Africa. So maybe just getting a sense of that, that inception, where was the business, conceived? What's South Africa's place in the portfolio?
Great question. We started off in April of 2022. Initial territory and initial geography was Dubai. Reason is that the founders were both domiciled in Dubai, so they had a presence there. They've done businesses in Dubai. They understand the environment well. We raised the initial capital from a seed perspective, European-based VCs. And there's a very keen interest in Dubai, especially when you look at it from a macroeconomic and a political perspective. There's a very focused effort in terms of cultivating business and making that a center of excellence globally. So, you know, when you look at whether it's Dubai or Saudi Arabia, there seems to be a very concentrated effort in terms of making it easier to do business in those jurisdictions, which means that it's very supportive. And that means that there's a lot of foreign direct investment and so on. So Dubai just made sense. And then when you started to look at SMEs more broadly, it's a very similar issue that you have faced in South Africa, and that is quantified essentially by something called the SME funding gap, which basically speaks to the demand that SMEs have relative to how well they're serviced from the banking sector itself. And you find that in most developing and emerging countries, the SME funding gap is quite considerable. In South Africa, for example, the SME funding gap is estimated at about 550 billion rand. Right. So, and it's similar in Dubai. I can't remember off the top of my head what that figure is for Dubai, but it's very similar. You know, you have a lot of SMEs, they need capital to grow, but they're unable to access it. So when we started to connect the dots across the board around the technology development, around the access to data, and this inherent need by SMEs for capital, as well as all the very supportive environment in terms of how to do business within Dubai, it just makes sense that you would kind of launch there. We did the pilot initially to prove the concept, and then we raised our initial pre-Series A round in November 2023. There was a combination of debt and equity. And on the back of that decision, there was one of our investors that was very Africa-focused, and they prompted us to start looking at Africa. And South Africa, you know, on a quantifiable basis, became the market that we chose. And the reason is South Africa's got a very sophisticated financial ecosystem, and the SME funding gap is very real. But at the same point in time, the level of sophistication of alternative lenders is quite good in South Africa, which means the model is well understood. There's a lot of institutional capital. So it on paper and the metrics, and when we look at the criteria, it made sense to use South Africa as the first market that we would look at from an African point of view. So we came into South Africa technically in December of 2023. We formally started, our first loan was deployed in May of 2024, and we're getting going. You know, we're building great partnerships here, and we're quite surprised in terms of our performance and how quickly we're accelerating. But at the same point in time, it was expected because it is a little bit better understood in South Africa than it is in the UAE. Where do we see South Africa going forward? It's super important to us. You know, comparably, when you look at the base of SMEs in Dubai versus South Africa, as well as the size of opportunity, it's fairly comparative. So we think that it's going to net out as being very compared, very comparable to Dubai over the long term.
All right. It makes sense from that point of view. And, you know, when I look at your cap table, I'm seeing some familiar names like Endeavor Catalyst that have actually been on this platform, you know, as some of the ones that, you know, may have that Africa focus, you know, that are there. And I guess the compare and contrast of the different markets, I think is going to be a very interesting data set that Flow48 is going to sit with after a couple of years, because these are very different markets, you know, different markets, different needs, and, you know, that type of thing. So maybe we can zoom in, you know, now into some of the detail for South Africa specifically, to say $10 million, you know, that's how much you guys have earmarked for this market. Is that is that the only money earmarked for South Africa, or is that the money, I guess, as it pertains to the Series A that is earmarked for South Africa? I guess trying to understand, you know, your firepower for, you know, the SA market. And then secondly, what are you guys, I guess, looking to fund? We spoke at the beginning quite a bit about working capital and, you know, that type of thing. But when we talk to other lenders, they tend to have, you know, certain criteria like, okay, cool, we understand it's working capital, but we are funding you up to a certain point, you know, whether 500,000, a million rand, you know, 2 million rand, whatever it is, we want to make sure that we're getting our money back within 40 days, 45 days, because we are just a stopgap, you know, between you invoicing and you getting your payment, you know, on the other side by your clients, that type of thing. Like, maybe we can get into some of that, you know, nitty gritty detail. Or do you also even provide some of that longer term, you know, financing? Maybe a business once has a big piece of machinery that they want to get. Like, what are some of the, how have you guys thought around that?
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack there, and please prompt me if I miss anything out. So I'll start at the top in terms of the $10 million allocation. It's not, the $10 million is what we're allocating at this point in time based on the debt that we've raised in the Series A. So we've already brought in quite a significant amount of capital into South Africa based on what we raised in 2023. This is just an extension of that relative to our targets for 2025. So it's just a commitment as we have it for 2025. We plan on expanding that as we progress. And that is excluding any OPEX requirements and so on, which we fund through equity. So the $10 million is what will end up being deployed to SMEs and will have an impact on the ground. And then as we, you know, the amount that you lend out relative to that $10 million increases because we reinvest all that capital as it gets paid back. So the net impact that you're going to have on the ground is quite considerable. It's probably multiples of that $10 million, even in the very short space of time. If I had to estimate it, it's probably four times that that value in 1 year that we have as an impact in terms of how much you lend out to SMEs itself. And the reason for that, which leads to some of the other points that you wanted to cover, is the structure of our products. Our products are fairly standardized. So if you look at the revenue-based finance product, it's a maximum tenor of 6 months. You could do anything from 1 month up to 6 months. And on the invoice-based finance product, it's a maximum tenor of 90 days. You could do anything from 30 days up to 90 days itself. And what that means is it allows us to deploy the capital, but also you recycle the capital pretty quickly, which means that the $10 million can stretch so much further than what you would do if you're just doing like fairly long-term loans, right? And it also helps us manage risk better, which helps us engage with our investors, especially our debt investors. So yeah, it's well aligned, and that covers the product itself. Is there opportunity for us to start looking at different product structures? Absolutely. What we're seeing is that the segment that we're servicing right now could be a very micro business, so anything a million rand of turnover upwards. But you could also get up to businesses that are doing up to 200 million that are looking for invoice-based finance, and they come to us. We've had many of those types of businesses that do well in excess of 100 million, but they need to be able to tap liquidity fairly quickly utilizing their invoices, and they come to us. But at the same point in time, what we do understand, and this is some of the research that we're starting to do, is it's not only the earlier stage business, the younger businesses, the lower annual revenue businesses that have this need. You also have this need with middle market businesses. So when I say middle market, I mean businesses potentially up to 1 billion in annual turnover. They tend to be underserviced by the banking sector as well. And when you look at what their product structure would be, it would be slightly different. You know, a 6 month loan in an RBF facility is probably too short for them. I'll give you an example. I had a conversation on Friday with such an interesting business. It's a private schooling business. They've got a presence in South Africa as well as in Kenya. They do a turnover of about $20 million per annum. They're in a high growth phase of their business, so fairly early stage, but $20 million is nothing to laugh at per annum, right? But they are unable to easily access financing from a bank, right? And there you probably would require a longer term product with more structured capabilities, and we will get there over time. So, you know, that's our commitment as we progress. But for now, our focus is embedding the structure, the products that we have in a standardized perspective. And we think that the market is pretty big in order to do that.
You know, as you're talking, it's quite scary, you know, to hear some of these stats, Altesh, because I think some of the previous conversations that we've had on this platform, the resistance level that I was working with in my head is that, you know, businesses at 100 million rand and below, you know, sort of struggle to get, you know, properly serviced, you know, by the banks. But, you know, at $20 million, that's, you know, maybe 300, maybe 350 million rand. And if you're saying that a business like that is struggling to tap into, you know, certain lines of credit from the banks, then what more of a business is just doing 5 million, you know, worth of turnover in a year?
Yeah, and I don't want to come across as being unnecessarily harsh on banks, right? Because I think you need to look at it in an impartial way. Banks are burdened with what is known as regulatory capital. So there's a lot of regulatory compliance requirements on banks in terms of the level of risk that they take relative to the amount that they need to hold as capital to make sure that they're compliant from a regulation point of view. That naturally what that does is it makes banks more risk averse, right? So as you see things like Basel III, Basel IV, and so on, there's an understanding of why banks tend to be a little more risk averse. There's a commercial understanding of that. So, you know, we shouldn't just look at it and be super harsh on banks. The question is, do banks, can they evolve and should they be evolving? I think absolutely. And I think to a large extent, what you are seeing is because fintech now it's no longer a cottage industry. You know, it's a billion-dollar industry globally. You're seeing very interesting market trends globally around where fintechs have evolved and they're maturing. And even in South Africa, you're starting to see these fintechs becoming banks themselves. They're acquiring bank licenses. Some of them are merging with banks. Some of them are becoming integrated with banks. Some of them are taking different shapes and parts. So I think banks are starting to look at that, and together with all the other technological advances that are happening across the world, banks are starting to ask themselves, hey, you know, what's my future in the world? You know, when you're a bank like Standard Bank and FNB and so on, and when you have banks like Revolut coming into the country, and these are banks that are entirely digital. They have a very different technology stack. They have very different DNAs in terms of how they operate. Yes, if they get banking licenses, they will also need to comply to regulatory capital. But the way they do their business and their business models is going to be fundamentally different to how the likes of an FNB, an Absa, or a Standard Bank would operate, or any traditional established bank. So from that perspective, what you are seeing is there's more incentive for traditional banks to start partnering with fintechs to basically expand the capabilities that they have to reach segments of the market where they're not reaching. So that's a very positive thing. From that perspective, I think the issue that you're facing in the sense that there's multiple segments of the market, even though these businesses are pretty well established, have got great profiles, but not by traditional standards, I think we're making the direction is moving in the right way in order to be able to start servicing those businesses itself.
No, it makes sense. And one of the things that I'm quite curious to understand is because you guys operate in a number of countries, starting off in Dubai, we're talking about South Africa now, places like Saudi Arabia. Is that same dynamic still at play? If I'm in Dubai and I'm doing, I don't know, 4 or 5 million dirhams, am I able to, you know, access that financing, or is an entrepreneur in that territory also facing, I guess, you know, similar challenge there that is being faced here?
It's a great question. And you know, I think that the short answer is yes. The more nuanced answer is a little bit different. So because of the policies associated with the countries in the GCC, more largely speaking, it's very positive. It attracts a lot of foreign direct investment. And one of the asset classes, more broadly speaking, that you've seen a lot of growth on since 2008 is something called private credit or private debt. And that is technically alternative lending as well, but it's not direct lending. And what I mean by that is they don't build technology capabilities or underwriting capabilities where they're able to process large amounts of volume to underwrite. But what they do is they set up big fund structures where they raise capital from institutional investors and they allocate it to businesses businesses that are not serviced by the traditional banking sector. So private credit internationally has grown quite significantly, and it's probably one of the best performing asset classes over the last couple of years. In South Africa, for example, the asset management community and institutional investor communities underallocated to private credits, right, for various reasons. But you're starting to see a greater intent to allocate to private credit. So why am I saying this to you? You find that in a region like in Dubai, right, you have a lot of private credit funds that have been established elsewhere that are now looking to enter the market in Dubai, and they're looking to potentially plug the middle market gap, or they're looking to fund businesses like ourselves, which makes the capital supply more readily available. The question is there an easy path in terms of how to access the SMEs and the middle market businesses? And that's what they're trying to figure out. So I don't necessarily think that you have a massive capital supply issue in Dubai. There's a lot of capital that's looking for transactions. It's about how you find the operational efficiency in order to do that in a cost-effective way to generate returns for investors as well as meet the need for SMEs. The one thing in South Africa is that, you know, the private credit, and when you look at even the asset managers here and so on, private credit has grown a little bit less so as it has grown everywhere else in the world, which means that the amount of capital that institutional investors have in South Africa to allocate to SMEs and middle market businesses is not comparable to what you're seeing elsewhere in the world, but there is a positive change there. So those are the nuances, but fundamentally, the access that is needed to this capital, irrespective of where the stage of development is more or less similar.
All right. One of the things I'm then keen to understand from what you've just said is this $10 million that you have running, this is obviously coming from the Series A, and you have a number of institutions on that, you know, on that cap table. Going forward, how does Flow 48 then fund themselves going forward, right? Let's say you want to increase the size of your book, that type of thing. Do you perhaps, you know, go back to the private market and say, maybe we're having a Series A extension, or we're getting into Series B, you know, to do that? Or do you use your traction in a market like South Africa to then go to some of the traditional lenders, you know, to say, listen, we understand that you can't, there are all of these businesses that are out of the net for you guys. You can have access to that market by de-risking yourself through us, right? Is that perhaps the longer term play? How are you guys thinking around that aspect?
Yeah, so very intuitively, I think you kind of covered it intuitively. So there's a separation, firstly, between our equity and our debt. Equity, what we'll do is we've raised equity capital through our VCs, and as time progresses, our revenue would need to cover our OPEX 100%. At this point in time, it's there, but it's not 100%. So as time progresses, the revenue that we generate from our core business would need to cover our OPEX. On the debt side, you know, we've got a lot of debt, and essentially what we're now building is a very strong track record, which then enables us to go and access capital markets, both public and private. So I'll start with the private guys, because it's very near to what I just explained on the private credit side. What I mean by that is, once you have a very strong performance track record on your credit policy, irrespective of the jurisdiction, so the credit policy is more or less similar in Dubai as it is to South Africa. And once you have a very strong performing loan book and loan performance, where you can confidently stand in front of a private credit fund, for example, and say to them that, you know, I've deployed $20 million in loans. I've got this performance track record in terms of collections, in terms of loans that have not performed well, and so on and so forth. It gives you the ability to basically gain access to private credit funds on scale, right? Which means that there's a ton of private credit funds globally, and some of these guys manage billions of dollars of capital. You know, one of the guys that we're talking to, for example, is a company that's got $50 billion of assets under management. So they've got a lot of capital, and they're very astute in terms of how they allocate that capital. And if you've got the right performance track record, they'd be willing to allocate that capital to you. So eventually what will happen is we start to leverage our performance track record to be able to increase the amount of capital that we can access, and it also makes it more cost effective for us to be able to do that. And a similar story plays out in the public markets, for example. You could go to the public markets where you do very sophisticated things like putting things into structures where you list it on exchanges, or you do things like securitization and so on. But essentially what that does is, on a collective or overarching umbrella, it gives you the ability to aggregate into wholesale facilities very cost-effective solutions to scale out your debt facilities.
Mm. All right. Now, it makes sense with everything that you're saying. And I think that roadmap is going to be an interesting one to see and observe, over time, to see the type of, funding sources you'll be able to tap into or to access over time, especially as the model's built out and as that traction is being proved, by your trading activity. Before we let you go, and I'm just coming back to South Africa because I guess this is most relevant, to our audience, is to say, from what you guys have seen in the market so far, are you finding yourself having perhaps longer term types of relationships with businesses, clients? Let's say, Mudiwa Enterprises is in that bracket that you're talking about. I'm doing, $10 million a year. I'm struggling to find to access certain liquidity, to fulfill my orders and that type of thing. I come to you guys, and we have that round. I get paid back. I pay you guys your money. Do you guys find that relationship continuing, where it's almost becoming like a revolving facility, or do you sort of, just find yourself getting, new people coming in, each time? Maybe, they just want that one round of liquidity and that's it. They're gone and they're out. Or, is it literally on a continuous basis?
Yeah, so firstly, I'd love to see Madhu Enterprises apply for a loan. It would be great to have you.
We're coming.
Before I answer your question, just to touch on something that we ended off on the last point. Capital markets as a whole, globally, is going through so much of change. It's like today what's happening with things like blockchain and beyond blockchain as well, artificial intelligence, what the future of capital markets is going to be super interesting in terms of your ability to participate, access capital, who participates. And we're super energized by that space. And ultimately, when we call ourselves a fintech business, it's not just about the underwriting component and making that efficient and making sure that you as a merchant and a potential borrower for us has a great experience. We also want to make the experience very easy and accessible to our institutional investors and beyond institutional investors. There's a bunch of people in the world that potentially historically have been excluded or have not been able to participate in capital markets fairly fluidly. And that's also something that we're interested in. We don't probably have the silver bullet in terms of what the strategy is in that regard just yet, but we're interested in terms of how to move forward. For now, everything that I've articulated to you about how we're accessing capital and capital markets is fairly accurate, but we do understand that that's going to change and evolve as time goes on, and it's potentially going to open up opportunities for us to be able to do things very differently as we progress. So that's something that's interesting, and the reason that I say that is it leads into our relationship with SMEs, right? Because the relationship with the SMEs for us, firstly, we're very service orientated, right? Number one is that we want to make sure that you as a business, irrespective of whether you want to be a one-time client or a repeat client, you need to walk away feeling like, hey, this is a business that we want to go back to, even though we just wanted to use them once. But the statistics are very interesting for us is because at the moment, and just after being in operations for less than a year, we've got 40% of our businesses that are coming back to us and taking repeat loans, which was very positive for us. If you look at it from a cost per acquisition point of view, it means that it lowers your cost per acquisition. You're not having to go and acquire a significant amount of new businesses repeatedly. You're actually getting businesses that you've lent out to previously stay with you. But more importantly as well is that we want these businesses to grow, and we want to grow with these businesses, right? Today, we have a product portfolio of two products, right? But as time progresses, as our businesses grow, we have no doubt that their needs are going to change. You know, what we see and what we envision is that businesses are going to become more global, you know, and I'd love to see that from a South African point of view, is that I think that to a certain extent and historically, South African entrepreneurs and South African businesses have been too local market centric. You know, there's a big world out there in terms of being able to offer your services and offer your products to the global world. So more businesses are going to become global. And the moment you start going global, it adds elements of things like treasury management, cross-border payments, and all of those things. So there's no doubt in our mind that as the businesses that we serve grow, what we provide as a service, as a financial services business, is going to expand as well. So we definitely are looking forward to that journey and are very interested in that journey. And hopefully we'll be able to build our product portfolio and our service portfolio aligned.
So Altesh, I think as a last point, you know, I want to touch on what you were just talking about now about, you know, the nature of capital markets, how people are accessing marketing, to say, you guys have just come out of a big, you know, funding round. $69 million on a Series A is pretty sizable. If you were operating as a solely South African business, that would be a record-breaking amount, because you typically don't see, you know, such rounds. Where you're in Dubai, I'm not sure, you know, how that tracks, but you guys have, you know, been on your own, you know, fundraising journey and accessing the markets. But at the same time, your core business is literally helping small businesses to access, you know, funding that's there. So I was hoping that as we end off, you could just talk to us about some of the trends that you're seeing in the market. But the biggest curiosity I have at the moment is from an appetite point of view, because a big piece of today's discussion has been around risk appetite, you know, from the market. Is it easier for small businesses to access debt at the moment, or is it easier to access equity at the moment? What are small business owners actually able to perhaps gain more access to right now from what you guys are seeing in the market?
Yeah, such a good question. You know, I think that more businesses need to consider debt because it's non-dilutive. But there's also a stigma around debt, which is perhaps a misnomer, right? Because debt is very beneficial to a business because it's tax deductible. The interest payments are tax deductible. It's non-dilutive, so you can grow. But generally speaking, the level of sophistication and financial literacy amongst, in the markets that we operate in are not that great. So, you know, you're transferring your personal understanding of what debt is and how potentially damaging it can be in your personal circumstances, because you don't have things like the interest being tax deductible. You need to be conservative in debt, even in a business environment. But debt is a great tool to use to grow your businesses. In terms of access, whether it's easier to access equity or debt, it depends on the level of sophistication of the market itself, as well as the depth of the markets, right? So in South Africa, for example, the VC ecosystem has grown leaps and bounds in the last 10 years, but it tends to be fairly conservative still. You know, they're still investing in much later stage businesses. There tends to be obviously a preference for tech businesses as opposed to what are traditionally known as brick and mortar businesses. So I would say that equity is not entirely easy to access as an early stage business. You know, you need to have a very compelling proposition. VC, by the nature of the asset class, you also need to demonstrate that your growth potential is quite significant. And that's that, you know, bringing those pieces together to be able to sit in front of a VC investor or an equity investor and have that conversation and to convince that investor that they should allocate capital to you is a challenge, right? So that's number one. And the market is becoming more sophisticated. So hopefully over time, as more entrepreneurs exit and more, there's more wealth in the country, there's probably more plowed back, and then it becomes easier, because this is a trend that you see globally when you look at things like Silicon Valley or any startup ecosystem where the VC ecosystem is quite established. You see a lot of exits, you see a lot of people plowing back money, and then it becomes easier and easier over time to access equity capital. Right now, today, in South Africa, I wouldn't necessarily say that it's easy to access equity. And at the same point in time, if you look at it, debt, while it makes sense, right, you need to have the debt serviceability. But even though our institutional market in South Africa is quite big, we've got a big asset management industry, our banks are quite big, generate huge amounts of capital as well. But only 15% of SMEs access finance through traditional banks. So that tells you, and when you strip out overdraft facilities and potentially credit cards from that, it tells you that, there's very little access that SMEs have to capital from a debt perspective. And this is where alternative lenders like us actually make a huge difference. And I think in South Africa, it's really interesting to see the size of the alternative lending landscape. There's a number of players, they're each focusing on different segments, and they're growing, and they're growing quite considerably. So that shows you that there's quite a significant appetite. So I think that because of the nature and the level of sophistication of alternative lending in South Africa, it's probably easier to access debt here than it would be in a country where alternative lending is fairly nascent, right? So that speaks to the access component and how easy it is to access. In terms of the trends and what's happening more broadly speaking, I think the whole digitization of value chains, irrespective of which business or industry you're looking at, it's undeniable that there was a famous venture capital company called Andreessen Horowitz a couple of years ago, maybe a decade or so ago, came up with a statement that software is eating the world. And it was so apt, right? Because that's true. I mean, if you think about it, it's like everything that used to be done manually before, software is kind of making it more efficient. It's making it more operationally efficient. It makes it more capital efficient. So today as a business, and now you think about AI and you think about all the tools that are coming online, there's a statistic that was recently released by Y Combinator that says even in a technology business that 90% of the coding that's being done is being done by AI as opposed to the software engineers. So that shows you the level of sophistication that we are in the world that we're operating with. It means that for businesses to digitize and to become more efficient in what they do is becoming easier and easier, and the costs to do that are greater. And there's a direct relationship and a direct benefit of that to what we do, because the more digitized a business becomes, the more data is accessible and the more we can access that to be able to understand what the risk profiles is. And it's not just the businesses that are becoming digitized. Our lives are becoming digitized. I mean, we walk around with these things in our hands and our lives are pretty much digitized all the time, right? So that gives me an understanding of the risk profile of businesses as well as the risk profile of the individuals associated with the businesses that are running those businesses. And almost every single player in the value chain associated with lending is cottoning onto this fact. I was at a talk the other day where one of the credit bureaus talked about the importance of alternative data, and they basically now have developed a robust strategy around how even something as traditional as a credit bureau that, principally historically just relied on things like FICO needs to start bringing alternative data points into their risk assessment profiles to give you a credit score. So you see all of these, this digitization effect is having a massive impact across the value chain on lending. You're starting to see, for example, previously aggregators in the industry that basically serve us and they bring SMEs to us that are looking for loans and they prepackage aligned to our requirements, those guys are becoming super sophisticated in how they do their business. Previously, you'd get a package of documents and so on, and they would email it to you. Today, they're actually building their own technology stacks. It's SEO optimized. We plug into their back end by APIs. And then it becomes machine-to-machine communication in terms of the information that we need in order to underwrite a loan itself. So that level of sophistication is happening across the value chain, and each of the financial services providers, whether they're massive, big institutions, institutions or an early stage business is I think there's an inherent understanding in it, and they're looking at how to capitalize on that. And it's super energizing and super interesting. So I think that in 2, 3, maybe 5 years' time, the landscape that we look at today is going to be so much different to what we know today. I mean, I saw that I got into direct lending probably around 2016 with the marketplace lending business that was backed by one of the big banks in South Africa. And when I look at how we operated back in 2016, which is not that very far away, it's like 9 years, it's chalk and cheese compared to how we operate within Flow 48, right? It's absolutely different in terms of the level of operational efficiency driven by tech. So I think what's going to happen in 5, 7 years' time is going to be so different, and how, and the influence that that's going to have on access to capital is going to be quite dramatic.
All right. So on that note, that's where we bring today's discussion to a close, just getting an understanding of what's going on in the world of Flow 48. They are, a lending business that operates in the, let's just call it the alternative lending sector. And, Altesh just giving us some insight into how, the business has actually gone about coming up with some of the different models, where they take future cash flows as a way, to turn that into, working capital. And he gave us some of their rationale into building, that particular model, because as an alternative lender, you need to decide which data sets you're going to be looking at. Where do you draw, this data that would otherwise be, ignored or be left out of the net by your traditional lenders. And he was just giving us some insight over there. Also getting a sense of what's happening in their markets, a business that was started, just under 3 years ago in Dubai, has since started operating in the wider, in the wider Gulf region, as well as Saudi Arabia and South Africa. They recently raised $69 million with $10 million earmarked specifically for South Africa. They entered SA, I believe you said, late 2023, starting to make loans from May last year. And he was also just giving us some insight into how working capital is one of those quick turnaround type of lending businesses. So you have one capital pool that's able to service multiple clients within short spaces of time, and from there you're able to build out that traction and start eking out some of your trends, some of your behavior amongst your business owners, that relationship with the business owner, starting to see where are the demands, which industries are looking for what, and what are the requirements that are needed there. And he was also then saying that as that traction is building, that then gives company like Flow 48 that ability to then go into debt markets, for example, to access even more money, more capital down the line, to expand some of the activities. Also giving us some insight into at the moment, is it easier or harder to get into, for small businesses to get debt or equity? And he was saying that, and this is something that we've spoken about time and time again, specifically around technology businesses, venture capital, etc. What's called venture capital in South Africa is often criticized as being private equity dressed up as venture capital, because of that risk appetite that tends to lean more conservatively. But Altesh just saying that small businesses should probably be considering debt a little bit more, because it's non-dilutive and it does come with that ability to expand. But if you're going to go into the equity market, you really need to have a really compelling case, especially in a country like South Africa, where some of your risk appetite lends towards you know, some of the bigger checks being written down the line as opposed to, you know, at the very start. So very interesting, and also just understanding some of the trends that are happening in the space. What is the place of AI? That's a term that we keep talking about here, and we're getting some insight into how that is even flowing into the world of capital flows as they pertain to small businesses. So that's been it. We've been in conversation with Altesh Baiju. He is the MD over at Flow 48. Altesh, thank you so much for being with us today.
Madiwa, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It was a great conversation.
And that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcasts on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter with hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. Thank you to our amazing team. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So for myself and the rest of the team, it is a good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.